Yeah, no, I'm pleased to be asked to talk about study groups as a path to insight, partly because I think that there's a perception that meditation retreats are where it all happens. You know, they're the big deal. And I'd like to do a plug for Tiruvannamalai. Because I think people can sometimes say, yeah, but Tiruvannamalai has so much talking. And they say it like that, talking. And the problem is. Actually, in my experience, I need both. I need an intense inner life, and I also need intense communication. And I notice that it's often in a study group that I break through into a deeper dimension of awareness, both of myself, of others, and of reality. Something happens between us that is greater than the sum of our parts. And it's different. It's different than being on my own studying, which I do love to do. And it's also a bit different than meeting up with just one other person to study, which I also love to do. So that's what I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk about insight, study groups as a path to insight. So as far as I understand it, in my understanding of Bhante's teachings, when Bhante writes or talks about the cultivation of insight, his approach falls into two broad areas. Okay, so I'm distilling it. From the subjective pole of experience, he talks about the approach of recalling the Dharma in an intense situation when you're pushed to your limits, when you're pushed to the edge. And when he's talking about the objective pole of experience, he talks about the approach that Dharmadina talked about yesterday of expanding concern beyond self-clinging by entering into deeper relationships with other people. And I would suggest that studying the Dharma in a group context cultivates both approaches. So the first is fairly obvious, because how can we recall the Dharma or bring the Dharma to mind if we don't know what it is, at least intellectually? And I think we also need more than individual study to look at what the Dharma is. Firstly, because I think studying in a group makes us go into areas that we don't necessarily want to go into. Some of us may have done the Higher Evolution series in the old style Mitra study, a series which I notice has been expelled from Mitra study. And I remember, I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about having to do that series, and I probably complained. But actually, I'm really, really pleased that I did, because so much of that material, the group and the individual and higher evolution of man, so much of it is so rich and so relevant to practicing Buddhism in the modern world. And we go through a lot of that material at Tiruvannamalai. So I'm constantly referring back to that, those teachings. And also it really inspired me, Nietzsche and Buddhism. Who studies that anymore? I loved it. I was in heaven. So without the Mitra study group, I probably wouldn't have studied it, and yet it's added so much richness to my life. And hopefully for a study group, we do a little more preparation for the group than just reading the chapter before we go to bed or doing a little bit of study here and there. Hopefully that's what we do in preparation for a study group. Because, of course, we've got to ask ourselves questions. We've got to prepare questions. We've got to think about where the group might go. And particularly if we're leading a group, you've got to be a little bit more on the ball with it, thinking about, well, what's the significance of this, and what areas might be fruitful to discuss? And what do I really think about it? And then we go to the group and we listen to other people's reflections on the material. And we reflect again on what we think. And we perhaps reflect a little more deeply than we would have on our own. We come into contact with other points of view, other reflections, other ways of approaching the material. And we have to go a bit deeper in our own reflections. So a study group aids both listening and reflecting. And then when we're in an intense situation, we're going to bring to mind the Dharma that has lodged itself deep in our psyche. And that's more likely to be something we've turned over with others, that we've reflected on in a group setting. I remember once at a Mitra Conveners meeting, we did some study with Bhante, and someone asked him the question about how do we reflect. And he says, well, you don't choose the reflection chooses you. And I think, well, what in a way is in there? What have I put in my psyche that's going to come out at the right time? When I was in Sheffield, I found in some ways just doing the Mitra study course a little bit limiting for my own exploration of the Dharma. And I set up a study group, which Satyajyoti came to. I think we were called the Study Nerds. And the basis of it was that we'd just study whatever I wanted to study. and in Pali and English. So we went through some of the Sutta Nipata. And it was a very, very rich time for me. I really appreciate, I really valued that opportunity that those women who came to it gave me. And I noticed that there was a time, still is increasing, whenever I'm in a time of conflict, some of those verses just spring to mind. Very beautiful, kind of very raw experience in the Sutta Nipata. And there's one, there's of course the quite well-known sutta, the Atadanda Sutta, where the Buddha has a vision before his enlightenment. He has a vision of people struggling like fish in water too shallow. And he says, when I saw this, I was afraid. I longed to find a place of shelter, but there is nothing in this world that is solid at base and not a part of it that is changeless. And then he says he discerns a thorn, and that thorn can be taken out. And there was a time when I was in a lot of conflict with someone else and was really struggling with my own feelings of disharmony and dislike. And I remembered those verses again and again. I would turn them over in my mind, and I discerned there a thorn, and that thorn can be taken out. What does that mean? What is that thorn? How can it be taken out? And it was almost as if that reflection had chosen me. It wasn't something I consciously... Well, what did the Buddha have to say about conflict? You know, well, I remember in the Madhyamaka Nikaya. You know, actually, it wasn't like that. It was direct and immediate. And it was because I'd had the opportunity to turn those teachings over again and again with my companions in the spiritual life. But there is more going on than learning the Dharma in a study group. I think that's what I'd like to also talk about. It's not just about yourself learning the Dharma so you can take it away and reflect on it. There's actually the group itself, and this is something that I've been exploring more on retreat at Te Ratnaloka. If for those of you who were on the mixed convention, there was a word that was kept on sort of being dropped in again and again. That word was magic. Because in a communication, magic happens. Magic happens when we expand our concerns beyond our self-clinging to a real awareness of other human beings. And Bhante says that this is the emotional counterpart to an intellectual understanding of anatta. This expansion, this reaching out to other people. And of course, it's essential in the spiritual life that we have an emotional counterpart to our intellectual understandings. So I'd like to look at what happens in study groups in three phases. And these phases are taken from a traditional list that Bhante mentions in Wisdom Beyond Words. And he mentions that list in relation to ethics. Subhuti, I noticed, also picks it up in Reimagining the Buddha. And I find this list very, very helpful when I'm reflecting on insight and the movement of consciousness towards insight based on this kind of expansion model. For those of you who were there, it's very similar to the approach that Vasantra drew on in his exploration of insight in the Metta Bhavana, the three unhookings, as he calls it. So the first is that when we enter into a study group, we start with separate ego identities. And you know what it's like. You kind of get into this group. And in Te Ratnaloka, we've sort of decided who's going to be in each group, but you don't really know what it's going to look like until all those people are sitting in the room with you. And I always get this feeling of, oh, is this going to work? And there's these kind of chasms. There's chasms between the selves and others, and you're all coming with your own stuff and your own reflections. And, you know, it can be, you know, I'm in my seat and that person's there. It all can feel quite separate. And what I've noticed is that people come down to defining their identity by views, and I certainly do this myself. I think this and that, therefore I am. And this, of course, is one of the four modes of grasping, the upadanas, which are ways in which we create the self, ways in which we create our self-identity. And one of the primary ways is views, ditti. So in a study group, we're faced with people who think differently, who have different views than us. How wonderful. It's such a pity when you get a study group where everyone agrees with each other. Because in a way, then you lose the opportunity to negotiate. You have to sort of be honest about what you think and feel and how you reflect on the Dharma, and then have to kind of negotiate with their understandings and their reflections. There's a wonderful talk that Banti gave a long time ago, which basically means I can't remember when he gave it, in the 60s, I think, 1967, I think. Anyway, it's on going for refuge. It's part of the meaning of conversion in Buddhism series. And he talks about communication there as a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and principle. And that's very much my experience of study groups. We listen and we respond. We change the way we think. It's almost like a kind of dance, this mutual responsiveness, listening deeply to another person and responding to them with our own thoughts and reflections. And I have to say, I find this very, very satisfying, just on a personal level, when I have a study group and I really feel like this vital mutual responsiveness is happening. And I think part of that responsiveness is dealing with our own reactivity. I have to say, I really dislike being wrong. And it happens with alarming regularity, actually. Yes, I'm sort of beginning to realise I'm wrong more often than I thought I was. Never mind. And I've noticed those key words that provoke me. And what I take those key words that provoke me is an invitation to go deeper. So I'll give you an example of this. I used to really react to the word authenticity because I just think, well, that just basically means being selfish, doesn't it? It's like, you know, I don't feel like I need to do this, so I'm not going to. So every time anyone mentioned the word authenticity in this study group, I could just feel my whole back. The eyebrows went. It's always a bad sign. And in a way, well, I had to ask, well, what do you mean by authenticity? I'm a bit more chilled out now, so what do you mean by authenticity? And what I discovered is that if I didn't react, actually what people mean is that they'd often mean that they wanted to be more real, more honest, more truthful, to what they believe. They wanted to be transparent or uncompromising. And what I realised is that when I was talking about being authentic, I was talking about being authentic to our sort of lowest motivations. But actually they were talking about being authentic to their highest motivations. And how wonderful if we were all authentic to our highest motivations. And I won't understand them. I won't understand them if I react. So we reach across the cavern and we see things from their point of view, and we're willing to be wrong. And I think in that process of explaining our deeper understandings and connections and insights into the Dharma, we help ourselves and other people integrate them. I think hearing other people's understandings helps us to reflect, but also trying to explain our own understandings to other people helps us to reflect on what we really know. So I think listening and reflecting and meditating work both ways. So you listen to others, it helps you reflect, it helps you to become the Dharma. But also when we have an insight ourselves, either with a little or a big eye, in explaining it to others, we come to a deeper understanding. It helps us sort of integrate that experience. And perhaps it takes that experience a little further. going last year to Bodh Gaya for the convention and then travelling on to Sarnath, I had a chance to really reflect on the significance of both the Buddha's enlightenment and then his communication of the Dharma to others at Sarnath and them understanding. And I realised in a way that was part of the whole experience. You cannot have one without the other. It was almost like the Buddha needed to further unfold his experience through communicating it to others and for other people to understand. And in a way, it was essential that I went to both places, because that's where not only the Buddha jewel arose, but also the Dharma and the Sangha. And it was in communication that something, some further unfolding happened to his enlightenment experience. So in this way, we explore together a spiritual dimension which neither could have explored on their own, as Bhante says. We get a deeper understanding of what is meant in the Dharma and what does it mean for me in my experience. And I remember once, it was Sahadra actually said to me that a deepening of the Dharma life is moving from the general to the specific. So we get the general ideas of the Dharma and we make them more specific in our own experience. But even though we're reaching across the chasm and we're responding to each other, we're learning more about ourselves and others, and perhaps we're even having our own self-construction challenged, there's still a sense of discrete and separate self-identities. So the second level of insight in this context is, or wisdom in this context, is to have a sense of others not as discrete entities, but as dharmas. So this means really seeing that other people are not fixed or separate. Subhuti calls this stage the stage of empathy. The life in us resonates with the life in others. He calls it a direct recognition of the same life in the being around one that one knows in oneself. So it's almost like we go from an appreciation of other people's views to an appreciation of them themselves. And that's where the distance between us starts dropping away. Jnana Chandra in the mixed convention alluded to this when she started talking about communication in which we become permeable. So I don't just feel the life in another person, I actually feel the Dharma as a living force in them. We are both changing, we are both growing towards the light, both of us grappling with the Dharma. And maybe it's a little glimmer of what it must have been like for the Buddha when, on seeing all beings like lotuses emerging from the mud of existence, he shook. And that's what I really can start to feel in a study group. I start to sort of shake, and it's experience of beauty, an experience of beauty of these, of us all beings trying to understand the Dharma, trying to grow, moving from the karma to the Dharma Nirma. And actually what I experience at this level is a lot of fear. Because where am I in all of this? I have this tremendous desire to give of myself, to truly give of myself, to let go of that kind of citadel of the heart. And that's very frightening, because there's not this you over there and me here. And what would it mean if I really gave myself? You know, if I didn't go back on that sort of order member thing of, well, you know, I'm the order member, you're the Mitra, and we'll carry on and have a tea break in a second. What would happen if I really gave of myself? And there comes into being a kind of a feeling of the spiral path, a force beyond the whole group. It's not really about us anymore, and distinctions dissolve into contemplation of the mystery of transformation. Human beings embody the Dharma, human beings moving on the spiral path, and that's magic. And any reactivity that I have seems such an inappropriate and impoverished response. So out of that deeper communication comes the third level. And the third level is silence, which is good because I can see the second orange moving towards me. And so fortunately, there's not a lot to say about that level. There are no distinctions. no distinctions between the individuals concerned, no ideas or theories. There's just, as one poet said, a mutual exchange of perfection. It's resting in the Dharma itself as a living force. And we get glimpses of this, get glimpses in a study group when it just falls silent, just silent. And also incredibly connected. Everyone's present, everyone's aware, and we're silent. And there's nothing left to say, just the Dharma. So I'd like to just end by one of my darlings, which is just to quote, actually, Bhante's section on communication from that talk, Going for Refuge. This is communication in the context of going for refuge, a shared exploration of the spiritual world between people who are in a relationship of honesty and harmony. The communication is the exploration, and the exploration is the communication. In this way, spiritual progress takes place. It may not be clear exactly how it happens, but happen it certainly does. Going for refuge to the Sangha takes place when, on the basis of a common devotion to the Buddha and the Dharma, people explore together a spiritual dimension which neither could have explored on their own. Of course, beyond a certain point, there is no question really of any sort of mutual relationship at all. In the process of communication and going for refuge to the Sangha, a dimension is eventually reached in which distinctions between the people involved no longer have any meaning. Such distinctions have been transcended.